Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me here. The topic that I'm going to talk about here is somewhat similar to what Eli talked about. You will have that, you will see some commonalities between the topics. However, my focus here in this topic will be on modeling. So rather than computing the mechanical properties of the tissue in vivo, I will be presenting a novel technique for modeling the tissue, modeling the mechanics of tissue. Just to give you an overview about what I'm going to present today in this talk, I'm going to give you an introduction about the objective, the motivation of why we are presenting this technique, and also I'm going to talk about the requirements of an effective and efficient deformable model, and you will see that we need a numerical simulation tool to do the mechanical modeling in addition to the tissue mechanical properties. And I will talk about each of these components separately. For the second requirement, the tissue biomechanical properties, I'm going to present techniques and results of measurements of ex vivo samples in addition to elastography techniques for measuring the mechanical properties of tissue in vivo. And then I will talk about the novel technique that the objective of this talk, basically. I'm calling it Fast Finite Element Simulator, or the Statistical Finite Element Method, and then I will summarize. Now, to give you an idea about why we are interested in this kind of work, why we are interested in modeling and having an extremely fast modeling tool, I apologize about having to use this instead of running the video and the PowerPoint presentation. It didn't work, unfortunately. And it's not working here either.
Man down.
Oh dear. Okay. It worked before the presentation. No, unfortunately, this video doesn't work. So what goes on, and let me stop this and go back to... At least I probably can show a bit of this, because the problem with this, it starts okay, but then stops prematurely. No. So, what this video is all about, it shows a battlefield where a soldier gets wounded, okay? And they take this soldier to an operating room. It's a battlefield, and as you know, there's no doctors and so forth. The whole operation takes place using a robotic system. And the robotic system, it's of course a cartoon, so don't be surprised, okay? So people are dreaming. Right? So, the robotic system uses an imaging system to identify the location of the bullets, right? So it uses the information of the body of the soldier, body of the soldier, in addition to the location of the bullets and so forth. And somehow, using the robotic system, they cut the tissue and pull out the bullets, right? Now, what's missing here in this video is the fact that when you use surgical instruments cut the tissue and insert the instruments inside the tissue will deform. And as a result of the tissue deformation, the location of the bullet will change. Okay? So the information that you get as a result of the image, and I imagine that imaging takes place only once because you don't want to irradiate the body of the soldier, okay, because there's safety issues. So you need to correct the information of the image, and you could do that using efficient biomechanics models, okay? Now, other potential application of this model is, for example, when you do image-based surgery planning. Two examples of which would be in the context of breast surgery, when you do breast lumpectomy or breast biopsy. So, for example, in the case of breast biopsy, if you want to do the planning based on MRI images, MRI images of the breast are acquired when the patient is position in this way, in a prone position. Whereas in the OR, the patient lies down in a supine position, okay? The information that you get, the MRI image information that you get out of this will be completely different, okay? So you need to make a correction to the image that you acquire pre-surgically. And for that purpose, you have to account for the tissue deformation, and you could do that using finite element analysis. For example, the finite element model of the breast in this prone position is this, then having the mechanical properties and so forth, you can get this deformed shape. So this deformed shape, you can turn it into an image, and you have the tumor location and so forth more accurately. You can use this information now in the OR setting. Another interesting application is when you develop virtual reality systems. With virtual reality systems, basically the objective is to train surgeons and radiologists. Of course, this would be much cheaper compared to training surgeons and clinicians having real patients. Of course, you also avoid risking patients' health because these are people who are not really skilled enough and may endanger the life of the patient. So what people do, they develop virtual reality systems, and they use, for example, in this case, surgical instruments, but they apply these surgical instruments on a virtual patient. And what this virtual patient is, this is hooked up to a model, basically it's a biomechanics model. You insert different forces applied by these instruments on this virtual a patient, and that this virtual patient is a bunch of sensors that senses the amount of forces and amount of deformations you're applying to the tissue, okay, and takes that information, feeds it into a deformable model, and gives you back the resistive forces of the tissue, so that the surgeon or the trainee will feel this kind of forces that they will feel in real surgery. Okay. The most important component you need for developing this virtual reality system is that you need a deformable model that is very quick. It should update the information, the forces and the deformations of the tissue, okay, very, very fast, real time. And this is the objective of this work. Basically, we want a deformable model that predicts the deformation, the forces and so forth, in real time or in near real time. Another possible application is in predicting the position of a lung tumor, as an example. Okay, we know that one of the effective treatment techniques for lung cancer is lung cancer radiation. And with lung cancer radiation, you need to minimize the radiation to the healthy tissue, and in the meantime, you want to maximize the radiation or control the dose of the radiation to the tumor, okay? And of course, the motion of the tumor is a hurdle. One possibility to overcome this problem is to predict, is to predetermine the motion of the tumor, and this can be done using a deformable model. Okay, Other application of fast deformable model is actually in the context of elastography. I'm glad that Dr. Van Houten presented some elastography stuff. He made my life easier here. Basically, we use the tissue stiffness as a contrast mechanism, and the reason for that is that it has been seen that pathology alters stiffness, and we know that because manual palpation is a popular technique for the preliminary assessment of prostate and breast cancer. And what we see here is the DRE, the digital rectal exam of the prostate, usually used to assess the stiffness or the alteration of the stiffness of the prostate for a preliminary assessment of prostate cancer. Okay, now elastography involves, as we saw in the previous talk, an inverse problem. One possibility to solve this inverse problem is to solve this iteratively, okay? And each iteration, it involves the determination of the displacement field, okay? The deformable model that I'm talking about here can be used for that purpose. It could be used as a solver for updating the displacement field. Okay, the other tissue, as I said, the essential requirements of this deformable model is first a tissue mechanics simulation tool. I'm going to talk towards the end of my talk. First, I wanted to talk about the mechanical properties component of this tool. One possibility of this simulation tool, of course, it needs to be numerical. It could be the finite element method. This finite element method, although it's highly accurate and so forth, it needs to be very fast for most clinical application, especially in cases such as virtual reality that I spoke about. The other component, as I said, the constitutive relationship parameters. You have various options. One simple possibility is to model the tissue as linear elastic. In this case, you have only two parameters to worry about. It's the Young's modulus and Poisson's ratio. And if you're dealing with compressible tissues, which is the case in most soft tissues, nu is a known parameter. The other possibility is to model the tissue as hyperelastic material. And in this case, of course, the number of unknowns is higher. It's at 3 and above. And this is necessary when we have large deformations. You need to model the tissue as hyperelastic when you deal with large deformations, which is usually the case with clinical applications. The other issue is isotropy. Is the tissue isotropic? Well, this is a question. Of course, we know that in muscles, for example, the isotropy assumption is very poor. But for other application, it might be acceptable. Now, in the beginning, I'm going to talk about identifying the mechanical properties of the tissues. What can we do to identify these mechanical properties? There are two possibilities. One possibility is to measure these parameters using ex vivo tissue samples. The other possibility is to do it in vivo, which is basically using an elastography technique. And I'm going to talk about these two possibilities separately. So, what can we do to measure, if we assume that the linear elastic model is appropriate for the tissue? We need to measure the Young's modulus, and one possibility is to use ex vivo tissue samples. For this purpose, the simplest way that comes in mind is using uniaxial compression, right? So you have a tissue sample, compress it. You have the geometry of this tissue sample, the height, and you have the forces that you apply. You can plot stress versus strain, okay, and the slope of this would represent the Young's modulus, okay? However, there are some problems associated with this approach. The most significant problem is that when you cut the tissue, you would have a surface that looks like this, all right? And when you try to load the whole surface, because of the non-uniformity of the contact, as you can see here, you will have stress concentration, which is unpredictable. It depends on these the roughness of the surface. All right? So you can choose to ignore the deformation until you flatten the surface, but of course you will lose a significant part of the mechanical behavior. So this is not a good option. The other option would be to use an indentation technique, which is basically to load a small portion of the surface. Okay, in this case, the Young's modulus would cannot be calculated as simple as we saw in the previous slide, as in the uniaxial test. It's not the slope of the force versus displacement data, because in this case you would measure the force, acquire the force data and the displacement data. Okay, in this case, the slope that you see here will not really be the Young's modulus. It will be dependent. It can be proven that this slope is related to the Young's modulus, but that relationship is a bit, it's not complex, but it requires some work to obtain this coefficient. So E, the Young's modulus of the tissue, is equal to a calibration factor times this slope. This calibration factor takes into account the stress non-uniformity inside the tissue as a result of this indentation experiment. Okay, and this could be obtained using numerical techniques or using experimental techniques. Some results that I obtained for breast specimens, okay, so I had 71 normal fat tissues, breast tissues, and normal fibroglandular tissues, and these are the mean values and the standard deviation, as you can see here. And also I had a number of pathological tissues, from benign to different cancerous tumors. Okay, and these are the results that have been published in one of the physics and medicine biology publications. One thing I wanted to mention here is that, you see, the standard deviation, at least in the normal tissue, is not very high. In this case, we are talking about less than 30% standard deviation, which means the variability of the mechanical properties or of the Young's modulus is not very high. Something else that you should take into account is that we did not really look into different groups of people, because here we have patients range from 30 years old to over 70 years old, and we didn't look at the variability that are related to the age. And actually, when you look at the raw data, there is some a strong correspondence between the age and the mechanical properties. Okay? This piece of information will be helpful in developing other elastography techniques that we will see later. Okay. Now, this is probably good enough if we want to use this information to interpret elastography images, like the images that we saw in the previous talk. Okay, to identify the type of disease based on the information that we have here, but it's not really very appropriate for modeling the tissue. So what do we do for modeling the tissue? To model the tissue, we need to take into account the tissue nonlinear mechanical behavior, because we know that most soft tissues are nonlinear, and they have two types of nonlinearity: intrinsic nonlinearity, which has to do to the fact that the structure of the tissue is complex. It has collagen, it has elastin, and because of that complexity of the structure, this leads to some intrinsic nonlinearity. And also we have the geometric nonlinearity, which is related to the fact that when you apply large deformations, the geometry of the object will change significantly, and as a result, of course the equilibrium equations will have to be formed based on the new geometry. Okay, so here is a typical force versus deformation behavior as opposed to the straight line that we saw in the previous slide. So you might argue that, well, why don't we use this tangential line and assume a Young's modulus or determine a Young's modulus based on that? Well, as you see, if you do that, if you look at this graph, you will see that you will be underestimating the forces very significantly. If you use the average, then depending on where you are and within this range, sometimes you underestimate the force and sometimes you will overestimate the force. So using an average Young's modulus will not really address this significant issue. An appropriate way of characterizing this nonlinearity is to use hyperelastic constitutive law. Okay? And in this case, to be able to do so, we use the so-called strain energy functions. These are functions that are functions of the strain invariants, I1, I2, and I3. If we have such an energy function, and we have a number of those, as we will see in the next slide, the relationship between sigma and the deformation, for example, B, is a function of the deformation, and I, of course, is the strain invariance. So this is a complex relationship that relates the stress to the deformation. Okay. So as you can predict, the math involved in this case will be a bit more advanced. Some examples of the strain energy functions. We have the polynomial form, we have the Ogden form, the Rodo-Boise form, Yeo form, and Rhonda-Westman form. And these are different strain energy functions proposed for different applications. Many of these applications have been proposed for assessing the mechanical behavior of rubber, and these are industrial sort of applications. But, for example, the Rhonda-Westman one has been proposed for biological tissues, and also the Rhodo-Boise is proposed for that purpose too. Okay? Don't worry too much about the form that we have here. All I want you to understand is that as these coefficients, these parameters, the C, the mu, alpha, and again C and a lambda, and C and so forth, these are the hyperelastic properties that we are interested in. We are interested in measuring. All right? Once again, two possibilities. One using uniaxial test, which is not a very good option because of the stress concentration and so forth, which is actually more critical in this case. We use an indentation test because of these shortcomings, right? And to formulate the problem, as you will see, measuring the mechanical properties, the hyperelastic properties, turns out to be an inverse problem. And it's a nonlinear inverse problem, to solve which we're going to use an optimization technique. Okay, to give you an idea, what we do here is to use indentation, run an indentation experiment. We get the force versus displacement data in this case. All right, and then similar to what we saw in the previous talk, we have the force displacement data, right, and also we have the geometry of the sample and so forth. We change the mechanical properties, the hyperelastic parameters of the tissues systematically in a way that the difference between the forces that we measure will be minimal. Okay? This, of course, requires, as you can see, to be able to get this component, the finite element part, the reaction force obtained from finite element. This requires finite element modeling, and this requires, if we are dealing with a tissue with a tumor inside, this requires segmentation, and we had to do that, and of course we had to develop some meshing algorithms to have an efficient and accurate finite element. Just a little bit about the experimental setup. To perform the indentation experiment, this is a homemade kind of machine that we built when I was doing my postdoc at Sunnybrook Hospital. It involves two major components. It involves a servo motor that applies programmed indentation profile, and it involves a load cell. And this servo motor and the data acquisition is all coordinated by a computer via a LabVIEW program. Okay, so using this device, and this is, as you can see, this represents a slice of tissue, right? So out of this, what we get a force displacement data, and we have some results here. As you can see, the frequency is very low, 0.1 hertz, because we're interested in the static response of the tissue. Okay, and here we see a typical response of a tissue mimicking actually phantom in this case. After conducting segmentation, so we have here a slice of tissue with normal tissue. This dark area represents the normal tissue, and here this part represents the tumor. Right? We do segmentation and turn this into a finite element mesh, and as you can see, the finite element meshing technique that we develop follows the contour of both the whole geometry of the slice and the tumor very nicely. Okay, and also it follows the geometry of the indenter as well. So based on this finite element model, we can use this optimization technique summarized in this slide. So we start with an initial guess for the hyperelastic properties. These are the Cs, alphas, and so forth that we saw in the strain energy functions. Here, these are steps that we take to develop the finite element model, okay? So we have a good estimate of the Young's modulus of the normal tissue because we assume that the surrounding normal tissue is linear elastic. It doesn't really undergo significant amount of deformation. So it's safe to assume that it's linear elastic. So we conduct the finite element analysis based on the given profile, the profile of deformation that we used in the experiment. Finite element analysis, so based on that we obtain this force and compare it to the experimental force, and if the difference between these two is not significant, then we terminate this procedure. Otherwise we go and update the estimate of the hyperelastic parameter. Some results to report. We have a sample of 44 pathological tissues, and of course we conducted the same thing on normal tissues as well, and these are the type of tissues that we experimented with. Okay, and these are some numbers as an example for the DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ, and fat necrosis and so forth. These are the different models that we use, and these are the numbers that we obtained. Okay, and these are typically the type of graphs that we obtained, just to show you the agreement between the experimental curve and the calculated curve based on the nonlinear finite element model. So in some cases it was extremely good, as in these cases, and in some cases this is the agreement is what is was not very great. So the other possibility is to use elastography. To use elastography to measure the hyperelastic properties of tissues. All right. How do we do that? We induce tissue motion, and this tissue motion in general, it could be quasi-static or harmonic. In this case, where we're interested in the hyperelastic properties, we use quasi-static technique. So after inducing tissue motion, we measure the tissue deformation. This could be done MRI or ultrasound, and even I have a project going on that uses optical flow technique for this purpose. So we use optical flow to identify the deformation field. Okay? And then reconstruct the hyperelastic parameters using an inversion technique. So just a little bit about the inversion technique. We start off with the forward problem. It's similar to what we saw. We start with a strain energy function. The Kostyuchev law is based on that. So for the polynomial DO, we saw this before. And also the other sets of governing equations, we have the equilibrium equation here, where sigma represents the stress, the Cauchy stress, and the stress-strain relationship, we saw this before too. Okay. Now, as we saw in the previous talk, even with linear elastic elastography, so linear elastography, the problem is extremely ill-conditioned, right? This is why we decided, well, because of the ill-conditioning of the problem, let's have some assumptions here, okay? Let's use what the so-called constrained reconstruction. This is based on the assumption that, of course, we use, as I said, quasi-static loading. And also we assume that the geometry of each tissue type is known from imaging. Not a very bad assumption, because usually with MRI, you could have the status information very effectively. MRI gives you that information. The other very essential assumption that we have here is that the hyperelastic parameters are constant throughout each tissue volume. Right? So you have the geometry of each tissue volume. So within each tissue volume, we assume no variability. So there is no spatial variability of these hyperelastic properties. Okay? Well, and the results that I just showed you in the previous slide for linear elastic models, we saw that, well, it's not a very bad assumption, especially that we didn't take into account the age issue. Okay? So we hypothesized that this might be accurate with hyperelastic parameters too. Okay. Now, how do we formulate the inverse problem? We start off with the stress displacement relationship when we deal with hyperelastic properties. This is the relationship that we have. U represents the strain energy function, I1 and I2 and so forth. These are also displacement dependent, and also the B bar also is a displacement dependent. Now, the displacements are known. We have acquired these displacements using imaging techniques or other techniques. Right, so we can rearrange this equation into this linear form. Right, what we have here is sigma, and A is a matrix which is related to the deformation information that we have already, and C is the unknown hyperelastic parameter vector. Okay, so it might seem that, well, this is easy, we can just invert this. The problem though is that we don't have sigma, we don't have a measure of sigma. This is why we decided to solve this iteratively. Okay? So we start with an initial guess with C, and as I will show you in the next slide, this is the flow chart that summarizes the technique that we have here. Basically, what we do here is that we start with an initial guess for the C values, right? We, of course, construct the A matrix. Based on the C values and having the geometry and everything of the tissue, the breast tissue, for example, we can conduct a nonlinear finite element analysis, right, based on the strain energy function that we've chosen, and we can calculate sigma, right? Now, having sigma and having A, we can invert this matrix and get a C, the C parameters, right? Now, these C parameters, well, we'll have to check for convergence. If they don't change much, then probably the problem has not converged, and we'll have to go back and go through another iteration. Otherwise, we just terminate the process. This is what we do. Okay, so in the step of inverting this linear equation, this is an overdetermined equation, right? And it seems that we can easily do this. However, it turns out, even with the constrained elastography, this is an extremely ill-conditioned problem, to solve which we had to go through some sort of regularization, and it's not one kind of regularization that we had to go through. We tested a bunch of techniques, and at the end we converged to the combination of these two or three techniques. The truncated singular value decomposition, Tikhonov, and Wiener filtering. We had to combine all of these to be able to get a decent set of results. Okay? Now, this is an ongoing project. The first thing that we did was to validate this technique using numerical validation. And here is a numerical breast phantom that is the finite element of which you can see here. All right? Three tissue types to mimic basically the fat, fibroglandular tissue, and possibly a tumor, right? And we assessed three different strain energy functions, Yeo model, polynomial model, and Vernda-Westman model. And the purpose of doing this exercise is to reconstruct these scenes. Okay? And this is the type of results that we were able to get with initial guesses that are like the uniform, as you can see, for the polynomial model, we've got these values with, and as you can see, the error is very insignificant. And of course, we added a little bit of noise to just mimic the noise behavior of the system. And as you can see, the error is not very significant in this case. Okay, just a little bit about the few graphs that represent the convergence behavior. As you can see, it's a weird behavior because of the fact that we use different regularization techniques, and also to see the agreement between the calculated and the input stress strain for different strain energy functions. As you can see, the agreement was very good. So, and we repeated this because of the complexities that we had with the Verinder-Westman model. It was a bit different from the polynomial and the Yo model. We conducted this experiment separately, and again, the results are very encouraging. So with numerical simulation, we had no problem, absolutely no problem, results very encouraging. So we proceeded with a phantom validation. With the phantom validation, what we did here, we constructed a phantom that contains three different layers, once again to mimic fat, fibroglandular tissue, and possibly a tumor, right? Now the issue with this is that we have to build the phantom in a way that it exhibits nonlinear behavior. If you go with gelatin and agar and so forth, these are linear elastic, especially when you apply small deformations, right? At least it doesn't really have the intrinsic nonlinearity. So we had to go with a different type of material. And for this purpose, we found polyvinyl alcohol, right, PVA. Okay, PVA had to go through cycles of freezing and thawing to exhibit various nonlinear characteristics. So we are able to change the nonlinear behavior by changing the concentration of the PVA. That's one thing. And the other thing, we change the number of freezing and thawing cycles, and that will control the amount of nonlinearity. Okay? And we applied 20% of compression in this case, which is very significant to mimic the large deformation. This is basically the phantom that we made, and we've been able to get this after a number of attempts. The major issue with building this phantom was the thermal stresses, because we put this in a fridge that is controlled, that is programmed, okay, and a number of times the screws just snapped as a result of the thermal stresses. And this came out on Friday, last Friday, okay? And what we have here are three tissue types. The first is the external layer. This is actually the tumor. It has 10% PVA with five cycles of freezing and thawing. The middle layer, it has 5% PVA and three cycles of freezing and thawing. And finally, the external layer, it has 5% of PVA, and we only changed the number of cycles of freezing and thawing, and in this case it was only two, okay? And we conducted separate uniaxial tests for each component. These are separate just for the purpose of validation. So we measure these using the machine that I showed you, okay, and then try to compare it to the results that we get out of this reconstructing hyperelastic reconstruction technique. And these are the forces that we obtained for these samples. As you can see, the behavior is completely hyperelastic. The second sample and the third sample, and we measured the hyperelastic properties based on the uniaxial test. Okay? Now, before we go ahead and use fancy imaging techniques, in this case we just use a bunch of fiducial markers to track the motion. This is one possibility, at least preliminary work is acceptable. And as you can see, these fiducial markers are realistic if you can use MRI imaging. With MRI imaging, you can really get this kind of resolution for motion tracking. Okay? And of course, we built the finite element model. Alright? And unfortunately, I don't have results yet to show you because it's an ongoing work. As I said, we conducted this experiment on Friday, and the reconstruction is going on. Probably during this week we're going to get something. Okay, so the last part of this presentation is the fast finite element simulator that I've been talking about. So we discussed the issue of the hyperelastic properties, the mechanical properties in general, and the second important component is how to create this fast simulator. Okay. Now, one possibility to do the simulation is the traditional finite element method, of course. It's highly accurate, but the problem with it is it's very time-demanding in terms of computation. Okay? Other possibilities, people have been looking at other possibilities such as meshless methods, okay, with not much success. Well, it's an ongoing type of research. It's a relatively new area. Okay, boundary elements models, these are still time-consuming, a bit better than finite elements. And also the mass spring models, people have done work on that too. The problem is that you can't really, the accuracy of the mass spring model is not very great. And finally, accelerated finite element models, one of which is the method that I'm going to present here. Okay, just to give you some background about what is the concept behind this technique. You see, biomedical applications of deformable models usually deal with certain organs, okay? Now, these organs, although they are different, but the difference is not very significant. When we talk about the brain, right, the brain of different subjects is similar, right? We don't have a brain that looks cylindrical versus another one that looks cubic, for example, right? Brain is a brain, kidney is a kidney, so there is a large degree of similarity between the geometry of the organ. And also, tissue elastic properties in a specific organ are somewhat similar. We saw that in the table that I presented to you, okay? The standard deviation of normal tissues was not great, and if we take into account the age factor, that variation is even smaller, okay? So, based on these two principles, why don't we look at deformable models as of an organ as a statistical sample, okay? And we'll call, because of this fact, we're going to call this technique statistical finite element method. Let's see how this works. The idea is adapted from the concept of statistical shape models. Many of you probably are familiar with this concept. How does this work? Okay. Now, if you look at an organ, in this case, I'm demonstrating the concept with the hand. Okay. If you just this is the discretized version of the outline of the hand. Right. It could be open. It could be closed. Right? It gives you the information about the outline of the hand. Okay. Now, if you do the same thing like in the previous slide, you can track the outline of the hand and of course, take into account these discretized vertices, right? If you do it for multiple subjects, 100 subjects, what you're going to get a cloud of points that looks like this, right? By using registration and scaling, basically the points that you select around the outline should have some correspondence. So for example, all the points that are located here should have the same label, okay? And as you can see, the variability here is not so great. All right, so how can we use this information to create a new hand, right? What people do in this case is they use the covariance matrix of the information that they get here and basically decompose this shape, okay, into the principal shape components, all right? And based on that, there is a very seminal paper in this regard by Kutz you can look at, all right? We'll see that based on this information, you can decompose any data set of a certain shape into its principal components. All right? So a linear combination of the principal components, and it gives you a new shape. So for example, if we look at this shape data set of a hand, right? It consists of 12 of these hands, right? All of these hands can be decomposed into three modes, three significant modes. All right, this is mode number one, mode number two, and mode number three. And this each mode, if you multiply it by a weight factor, it gives you a different hand. If you combine these, it'll give you a new hand which looks different. All right, so this is the concept behind statistical shape models. How are we going to use this concept in developing this technique? Okay, so for the shape space, we have this relationship. X represents the vector of the outline of the organ. That's equal to the mean value of that vector plus, as I said, the combination of the linear combination of the principal modes. And these principal modes can be obtained using the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix. Okay? Now, we can extend this idea to the finite element analysis, to the statistical finite element method, and we say in the finite element space, right, we have a similar relationship. U, which is the displacement field, is equal to the U bar, which is the mean value of the displacement of the number of organs that we've analyzed, plus a linear combination of the principal modes. Okay? Now, how can we use this to conduct a very fast finite element analysis? All right. So before I get to the next slide, you have a bunch of shapes. You have a bunch of shapes that are related to one organ. This is a database of shapes. Say we're talking about a kidney. So 100 or 1,000 kidneys that you're looking at, right? You take the outline of this kidney, right? Use this equation, right? It will give you the B value. These are the weight factors. Basically, each shape has a specific B value that gives you the specific shape. That will give you that B. Conduct the finite element analysis on the same shape, right? Based on the boundary conditions, forces, and whatever, and using a certain constitutive law, it'll give you U, and based on that U, you can calculate C. So these are, once again, C are the weight factors that are used to calculate the displacement field. Right? So you have a bunch of B's and a bunch of C's for the data set that you have. And the purpose would be, well, what about if you have a shape, a new shape, that is not included in this data set? What you want is very fast estimate of U. Let's see how we can do that. Okay? One thing that could come to our minds, which I actually tested, is why don't we establish a relationship, like a fitting model, between the B's and C's, right? So that any new B will fit out a C, and based on that C, you can calculate the displacement field, right? So we tested several functions, including polynomials and so forth, but we realized that, well, the problem is more complex than that. So what we decided to do is to use something that you have to worry about, I just discussed it. We use a neural network for that purpose, because it's such a complex relationship between the B's and C's. So we use a four-layer feed-forward back-propagation neural network to establish a relationship between the B's and C's. Okay? And once you have this neural network relationship, now you have a new shape, right, of the same organ. You can easily get an estimate of the B, because you know what the X is by just doing this inversion. You have the B, feed it to this neural network, it's going to give you the C, and just plug the C in this relationship, right? It gives you a very accurate estimate of the displacement field. And based on the displacement, you can estimate the strains, you can estimate the stresses, and so forth. And this is exactly what we did. Just to test this idea, we tested a shape which is, this is a numerical simulation basically. We generated a number of shapes that resemble the prostate. And actually, in this particular case, we considered very large variability, like unrealistic type of geometric variability, just to see how this works. As you can see, these are very different, could be very different prospects. Okay? Conducted finite elements, like I think we had about the 200 shapes that we generated numerically. Okay? Conducted finite element analysis for each of them. And as an example, I think this is for the linear elastic. You can see the accurate finite element technique gives you this field for the one of the displacement components. This is the second displacement component, and this is for the FFEM, the proposed technique. Very good agreement. Okay. Now, we extended this for different other applications. So not only linear elastic, we use hyperelastic model. We use the contact modeling with linear elastic, contact modeling with hyperelastic modeling, and we conducted the same exercise, we conducted the same experiment, okay? And this is the kind of result that we obtained. As you can see, the maximum average error that we obtained for each node for the displacement, of course, it increases slightly. For the linear elastic, it is minimum, but when you increase the complexity of the loading, increase the complexity of other factors, it increases, but still it's very acceptable. Okay? Now, the finite element analysis that was done by Abacus in terms of seconds, we have between 8 to 14 seconds, whereas the SFEM, it took only 0.07 seconds. All right? Very, very fast. And this could also be reduced, of course. It depends on the processor of the computer and so forth. And these are the speed ratio of the proposed technique to the traditional finite element technique. And as you can see, the more complex the geometry, the loading, and so forth, the higher this ratio. Okay? This is just a video to show you the one of the contact problems that we ran. Okay, now just to explore the potential of this, right? Is this only applicable to tissue mechanics? Is this only applicable to tissue biomechanics, or it could be applied elsewhere? Okay, we decided, well, why don't we try this to CFC, for example, the hemodynamics of carotid artery? It's the same concept, right? And probably in this case, it's even more appealing because conducting CFC takes hours and hours. A typical hemodynamic assessment of a carotid artery takes a couple of days using a cluster of computers, right? If we can apply this idea and probably do this analysis using a fraction of a second, why not? It would be a big achievement. Okay? So this is an ongoing project. David Simon and I have been working on this for the past couple of months. It hasn't been long. Okay, the hurdle here is the finite element mesh, because you can't use any finite element mesh to do this exercise. The finite element mesh that you use here, you have to have the nodes correspond to each other, because each node will have to mean something, right? Otherwise, the basic idea is some sort of interpolation. So when you look at the displacement or the shape, if the nodes don't correspond to each other, the advanced interpolation that is here applying will be invalid. This is why the finite element meshing here has been a hurdle. We've been working on this using various possibilities, and we hope that once we have the finite element mesh going that relates each point node to each other properly, then we can easily apply the same concept, just train the data using a neural network, and we should be able to get the same sort of results. Just to summarize my talk, as I showed, many biomedical applications can benefit from an efficient and fast biomechanics simulator, tissue biomechanics simulator. Okay, such simulator could be physics-based, which for of course the accuracy. So finite element model could be one possibility, and also it requires accurate biomechanical properties, as we saw. I discussed that in details, and we decided that the variability, well, at least based on the data that we have, is not very significant, so this justifies the approach that I took here. I also discussed possibilities for measuring the mechanical properties both in vivo and ex vivo, and we decided indentation technique is very effective for measuring the mechanical properties ex vivo. Also, I presented an indentation technique to measure the hyperelastic parameters of a large number of breast tissue samples. I showed you some results. Also, a nonlinear elastography technique is being developed in my lab, and I showed you some validation assessments. So far, the results have been encouraging. And also showed you the novel statistical finite element technique, and showed you some applications that has been successful and highly accurate, very fast for tissue mechanics application. And also I showed you a potential for applying the concept in other biomedical applications, such as assessing the hemodynamics of the carotid artery. Okay? Thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.